We're here for argument in the case of People versus Summers, and we're ready to hear from our petitioner. I understand one of the attorneys has visual problems. I'll just tell you when the time is. I'll give you a 10-minute warning and a 5-minute warning. Okay, thanks. Please, go ahead.
May it please the court, I'm Norman Mueller and I represent the petitioner, Mr. Eugene Summers. The issue in this case, as the court knows, is whether the 2002 amendments to the statute of limitations for sexual assault are retroactive or prospective. I want to first address the recent decision, I think just 2 weeks ago, of the Court of Appeals in People versus Boston, because they decided the case contrary to my desired conclusion, but on grounds not briefed either in that court or in this court. So I want to start with that and explain why that decision is wrong. The Court of Appeals ruled, I think, that because there was a safety clause in the enacting legislation here, that combining the safety clause and reading it in conjunction with the effective date clause means that you can essentially ignore the effective date clause with regard to interpreting whether or not the change in the statute of limitations was retroactive or prospective. Because the Court of Appeals essentially ignores the effective date clause in the bill, Section 5 of the bill, they said there is no conflict between the bill and the substantive portions of the law. Mr. Whitley, as you know from his brief, says that's the problem, that's the rub, because there is a clear conflict, according to him, between the effective date clause and the substantive provisions of the law. There are a lot of problems. The main problem with the Court of Appeals decision is that it ignores the fact that it is not just an effective date clause. It is a clause that says the law shall take effect on passage, and it explicitly provides that it is a prospective change in the statute of limitations. It shall apply to acts occurring on or after the passage date. The court doesn't say anything about that and completely ignores the fact that it is an effective date plus. It is also an explicit direction that the law shall be applied prospectively.
Mr. Mueller, with respect to that particular, what do you call it, the effective date clause?
Yes.
What do you think that it says, except as otherwise provided in subsection 2? What does subsection 2 refer to?
That is referring to subsection 2 of section 5.
Not section 2 of the actual House bill?
No. It is referring to subsection 5. It says subsection 2 of this section, which means section 5. And what is subsection 2? Subsection 2 is the contingent provision saying this doesn't even become law unless these various funding contingencies occur. So that's what that reference is to, Your Honor. The other problem with the Court of Appeals decision is that it relies on a 1919 decision from this court, In Re Interrogatories. That decision didn't deal with an effective date clause. That decision dealt with the interplay of provisions, a safety clause and an emergency clause, and dealt with a now amended section of the Constitution. Back in 1919, Article 5, Section 19, provided that the legislature could not declare when an act became law. The law became effective 90 days after the legislature had adjourned. What was the purpose of that? The purpose of that was to basically make all laws subject to the referendum process, because the referendum provision in the Constitution provides that the people have 90 days to change a law passed by the legislature through the referendum process. That 90-day provision had the qualifier except in cases of emergency. So what the Supreme Court was deciding back in 1919 is what is the effective date of this particular statute? What is the effective date? And what is the, can the people attack it by the referendum process if, for instance, there is a safety clause but no emergency clause? What's the effect if there's an emergency clause but no safety clause? And what's the effect if both you have an emergency clause and a safety clause? Didn't have anything to do with an effective date clause, didn't have anything to do with an explicit legislative directive like we have here that a law is to be applied prospectively. And the court's decision really contains no discussion or analysis of their conclusion. They just state the conclusion and cite the 1919 case. So since that time, of course, I think it was in 49 or 51, the Constitution was amended. And now the legislature can declare when an act becomes law. And if they don't declare when an act becomes law, it becomes effective on the date of passage. In this case, the legislature explicitly stated the law is effective on passage and it shall apply to acts committed on or after the date of passage. There's also a throwaway paragraph in the decision, which I think should be very troublesome to this court, at the end of the decision. The Court of Appeals says, oh, and by the way, we think we can ignore the effective date clause because it doesn't appear in CRS. Well, there are most statutes do not have the effective date in the CRS. Most laws don't have the safety clause appearing in CRS. And I would beg to differ. This effective date, not only the effective date, well, I'm not sure about the effective date. I do know that in both of the statutes amended, 16.5401 and 18.311, the editors put an editor's note at the end of both statutes saying, hey, everybody, these changes in 2002 apply to offenses committed on or after the passage date, and the passage date was June 3rd, 2002. This court, of course, and the Court of Appeals has given effect to effective dates. They have cited effective dates. This court and Court of Appeals often cite session laws, and in fact, it is the session laws that are the official record, of course, of what the legislature did. The Court of Appeals, again without discussion or analysis, cites a case called Suncor. That case is readily distinguishable. What happened in Suncor was that the forgery law was changed, and there were many acts included in the old repeal forgery law, making, uttering, delivering, etc. The legislature said making. The defendant was arguing that the legislature meant more than making. And what did they refer to? They referred to the effective date clause in that statute. And in the effective date clause, there was also an applicability clause. The legislature said, this shall apply to devices or whatever phrase they used, that were made or written. So what the defendant was arguing was that addition of the written language meant something. It meant that although the legislature and the substance of the bill just used the word made, they really meant to do at least these two things. And you can read the decision and see why that would have helped the defendant. The court said no, the use of the two words, made or written, really had no substantive effect, no effect on the substance of the amendments that the legislature made. Again, didn't have anything to do with effective date, didn't have anything to do with prospective or retroactive application.
Can you tell me when that effective date clause on or after regarding the offenses appeared in the bill as it went through? Did it start with that? Was it amended in?
Here's what happened, Justice Hobbs. The law, as initially written, was retroactive. And it shows, again, how the legislature can not only deal with the effective date, it can deal with retroactive or prospective application. The bill, as originally introduced in the House, and Mr. Whitley did a good job of attaching most of the legislative history to his brief, that original bill is there, and it shows that the bill was to take effect on July 1, 2002, not upon passage, and it was to apply to offenses on or after July 1, 1992.
And that was in the equivalent of an effective date proviso at the end of the bill, or was it internally? I know you set it out here, I just don't remember.
No, it's in the effective date.
Okay.
Provision.
It's the same kind of a piece that may not appear in the CRS, but is in the session law.
It wasn't in the session laws because it didn't get passed.
Right, I understand.
Yes.
But it would have been the same thing.
It would have been exactly the same thing. That's what would have appeared in the session laws.
Right.
And it was then Section 3 of the bill. So here's what happened. Okay. The bill goes through the House, and of course, as we all know, the legislature looked at it for fiscal impact. Even though it was going to be a retroactive bill at the time, even though it was reaching back 10 years, the legislative council said, minimal fiscal impact. This is going to result in one prison bed each year. They then added a section, which I think, if I'm right, became the new Section 3, moving the effective date clause down, saying we're going to exempt this from the requirements of, it's entitled to 202203, or I'm not positive about the statutory site, but that's a statute that says anytime you're going to start expanding the reach of the criminal law in Colorado, you've got to pay for it. You've got to analyze what's going to happen to the Department of Corrections. You're going to have to analyze what happens to prison beds. You've got to pay for it. But you don't have to do that if you say it's minimal fiscal impact and you can do the exemption. So they did that. Leaves the House, goes to the Senate, goes to the JBC. When it gets to the JBC, that's what we attach to our reply. And the report of the JBC says, Legislative Council has decided that there's a minimal fiscal impact, but you know what? They're saying that about all these criminal bills that are coming through this term. And that we can't keep exempting every criminal statute that's going to increase prison population by not paying for it. So we are going to add the money. And that's what leads to what became Section 3 with all of the appropriation, all the fiscal language. At that time is when they also made it prospective. They changed what the old Section 3 became the new Section 5, and the new Section 5 said this act shall take effect upon passage and it shall apply prospectively. It applies only to acts committed on or after the passage date.
What was the fiscal impact at the second time? Because it seems to me that cutting across to your argument that if it was prospective only, you wouldn't have any fiscal impact till 2011.
I don't disagree with that, Your
Honor. And that if there's a fiscal impact in 2003, obviously it was intended to be retroactive.
Well, I disagree with that. Because what the legislature did was say, and if you've got, I think if you read the JBC report attached to our reply, it really, I think, says what's going on. Number one, they say we've got a number of bills that have come through here, and you can't tell what bills they're talking about. You can't tell where they are, but they have seen them apparently because they talk about them, and they don't identify them. So my position, Your Honor, is that they then added the money, and it's not a lot of money. It's $27,000 a year. I mean, I think it's $60,000 for the first year and then $27,000. So it's not a lot of money. But the JBC is very cognizant of the fact that they have a group of bills coming through here that are being exempted from the requirements that they be paid for. And all I can tell you is what happened. And My client didn't have the resources for us to go spend hours listening to legislative tapes. Mr. Whitley indicated, and I trust his word, that somebody did from his office, and that there's no real discussion of this. I mean, he talks about the fact that all that is discussed is the fiscal impact. But at the same time they add the money in, they do two other things. They make it prospective. They can't be clear. I don't know how you can say it more clearly that this is a prospective bill. And then they also make it contingent. They make it contingent on these other fund, another bill being passed. My conclusion from all of that, and we're going to get to why maybe we shouldn't be mind readers and just follow what the legislature told us, is that the legislature saying, well, here's a chance, we've got this in this bill, we can leave it in, it's a minimal amount of money, and DOC is going to make it, it's certainly going to be incurred at some point. I also would say that arguing the legislative council's prediction that this is one prison bed a year is you know, sort of fantasy. The impact would be a lot more than that if the bill was indeed retroactive.
Can I just ask you a question about the sentencing in this kind of crime? Are these sentences indeterminate to life sentences if the defendant's convicted of these types of crimes?
Well, they are today, but the law applicable back in 1992 and 19...
Well, when the bill was going through.
Oh, when the bill was going through in 2002, yes, the indeterminate sex offender life supervision, I think, occurred in 1998, if I'm right.
Okay.
I'm not positive about that, Chief Justice Mularkey, but I think that's when it was. It was 98.
Mr. Mueller, returning to your point about the appropriation, are you saying that at the end of the day, they said, well, let's just give them the money anyway, even though the way we've changed the effective date, there is no fiscal impact? Is that your theory?
That's the best theory I've got for what the legislature
is. Well, that's one. I mean, another theory, I suppose, would be, and this is where I thought you were headed, but you didn't go there, and that is, well, they mentioned some other bills, and so they just put that money in there to deal with the other bills that were perhaps not dealing with the appropriation. Since we don't know what those bills are, I suppose that theory is just about as good as the statement.
Well, I think it is, Your Honor. I mean that's what I am saying. That's why it was left in, was because of the...
So you could put those two theories
together,
if you will. Or I suppose the final theory would be they did see a fiscal impact and the effective date is a mistake.
Well, I don't see how you can say... It isn't just the effective date, Your Honor. They did two specific changes. They said, we're going to change the effective date, not to what we most commonly see, July 1 of after the legislative session. That's what we see a lot of times. They changed it to passage, and then they also changed the applicability clause in that sentence. They didn't say they had it as July 1, 1992. They had a date specific, and they said, no, we're changing it to being prospective. It applies to acts on or after the passage date.
And they just forgot to change the substantive parts?
Well, Your Honor, you know, I know we have all dealt with the legislature, and nobody is going to say that this was an act of great draftsmanship. But I don't see how this is the last thing the legislature did. Because when the legislature made these changes, it went to the Senate, it got passed, it went to the House, and it got passed. And to rule against me, this court has to do what Justice Scalia says you can't do. You can't be mind readers. This is a explicit provision, and it's more than just the effective date. It's just as easy for me to stand up here and make the argument that it was a mistake that they didn't go back and change the substantive provisions of the bill once they'd made the decision to make it prospective. Now, I have given you an explanation of how it could still be reconciled because of the way they did it in the first place, and that is, in both the flat 10-year statute of limitations, they have a provision that applies from 79 to 92. when they go to the new 18 plus 10 statute of limitations, the new provision, it applies to offenses after July 1992. Now, the legislature often is very specific, and they did it, I think, it was either in 18.3.111 or 16.5.401. When they're talking about the statute of limitation that's in the subsection, they use the word this. Throughout the statute, when they talk about the 10-year statute of limitations, they are talking about the historic 10-year statute of limitations.
Okay, give that argument again to us very plainly, then, about the 1992 and the 10 years and what it applies to.
Okay. In what is subsection 2A, the old flat 10-year statute of limitations, it now says it applies from July 1, '79 to July 1, '92. That is, I don't think there's any doubt that that applies. That means the old 10-year statute of limitations, because by 2002, the statute would have run.
I'm sorry, Mr. Mueller.
Yes.
Would you just, which of those two? You talking about the general or the specific?
Well, I don't like to use the phrase general and specific, and I'll get to that, Justice Bender. I would call them the parallel or redundant statutes, but we're talking about 18, I probably don't have it in front of me, 18.3.111.
Okay.
Yes.
411?
411.
Right. Do I have the right number?
411 2A?
You do.
I do? Okay,
18.3.111.
18.3.411.
18.3.411. Yes.
Sorry. And it's 2A where they have the date range for the old flat 10-year statute of limitations. Then when they add, in subsection 2B, they add the 18 plus 10 statute of limitations. They say this, they don't say this statute of limitations. They don't say this new 10-year plus 18 plus 10 statute of limitations. They say the statute, the 10-year statute of limitations. Now,
that's the bridge, the 92 to 2002 period, is that?
Yeah, and the district attorney's argument is, well, that shows that it was retroactive, and it certainly was initially intended to be retroactive. But you can read that statute as saying they went back, and again, here we are mind reading, which we shouldn't be doing, but because we should just be following what the legislature said, prospective only. But you can read that, and if it is read to mean the 10-year statute of limitation, they could have done it differently. They didn't have to do it this way, but it means there's no gap. And the other thing the legislature was doing is they were changing the effective date. They had the effective date of July 1, 1992, and then they changed it back to passage. Did somebody look at this and say, oh, we're okay because we made, there's no gap as the legislation is currently drafted? I don't know. We don't know what they did. But if it's read that way, then it can be reconciled. But here's what can't be reconciled if this law is retroactive. In the redundant parallel statute, 16.5.401, they said nothing about it applying to acts on or after July 1, 1992. There is no date range. And the only way the district attorney can answer that argument, because then, if they're right about the 18.3.411, it's retroactive, but 16.5.401 is not retroactive. These are redundant parallel statutes. We can all say the legislature might get their act together and do it in one statute, but they haven't. They keep amending both of them. And it is not retroactive. And the district attorney says, well, it doesn't matter because there's a pre-existing clause in 16.5.401 that applies to all offenses back to 1984. Well, you can't apply this new statute back to 1984. Any offense committed in 1985 is barred, even if the statute was retroactive. So that cannot answer the question. So for this to be retroactive, as the district attorney argues, means that we now have two conflicting statutes. You can't do that.
Well, counsel, can I stop you there and ask you about your statutory interpretation? Are you suggesting that the way you're reading the statutes, that there really is no conflict here? That basically the language of the statute supports your position? Or are you saying that there is a conflict between the effective date and the substantive provisions?
I am saying, Justice Ide, that this, my interpretation can lead to the statutes being reconciled and that there be, that there is no conflict. I don't particularly like it, in all honesty. I don't really know what the legislature was doing. I don't know if they, once they decided it was going to be prospective, they said, well, you know, we really don't need to go back and change this because we don't have a gap here. I don't know that we can, you know, give them that much credit. They went back and looked at it carefully. But if I'm wrong, and if there is a conflict, then we get to the rule of lenity. And it's not only the rule of lenity. As this court knows, any statute of limitations in a criminal case has to be construed in favor of the defendant. And I get to the point, finally, of what did the legislature last do? They changed it from retroactive to prospective, and they couldn't have made it clearer. And there isn't one case that this court has decided that says we can ignore what the legislature explicitly tells us regarding prospectivity or retroactivity.
Well, tell me about in 2002, were there any cases or legal doctrine or rubric that suggested there might be a problem with extending the statute of limitations?
No, this court has consistently held, I may disagree with this holding, but this court has consistently held that there is no ex post facto problem for extending a statute of limitations to that limited to the cases in which the statute does not run.
Okay.
This court has held you can't revive it.
And that was clear at that time.
That was clear at that time.
Okay.
I think that was clear.
So we can throw out that explanation for somebody being cautious about this.
Well, I think that law has been well established by this court.
Mr. Mueller, can I ask one question?
Yes, Justice.
I think I might have misunderstood the sequence here, and I'm not sure it affects your argument really, but when did you say the 10-year statute of limitations came into being?
The flat 10-year statute of limitations, I didn't say. And
What were you saying the 79 to 92 applies to?
Well, that's in... Here's what I... I see what you're asking, Justice Coates. The flat 10-year statute of limitations in subsection 2A of 18.3.411 went back to 1979, reached back to 1979, and I believe... Well, I could be wrong, but I think it was passed in 1985. That flat 10-year statute.
I'm having a little trouble seeing the significance of the 1992, unless that's when the 10 years came in. So in 2002, one could make it retroactive back to 92 and still cover any crime for which the statute had not yet run.
I don't disagree. That's what the statute was originally intended to do.
Okay.
It's just that the legislature changed its mind and said, we're going to make it prospective. And that's what they said, and this court can't ignore it. I'll reserve my 228. Thank you.
May it please the court, I'm Robin Whitley. I work for Denver District Attorney Mitch Morrissey, and I'm here representing the people of Colorado. I'm asking this court to discharge its rule and to leave in place the district court decision allowing us to prosecute the multiple child molestation charges against petitioner Eugene Summers. The parties don't dispute the pertinent facts, nor do we disagree on the controlling legal principle. We differ only regarding the 2002 General Assembly's intent in enacting its House Bill 1396, namely whether the General Assembly intended the new statute of limitations to apply retroactively to crimes already committed. Our conflict exists because a legislative drafting conflict exists. So your task is to discern the General Assembly's intent by looking at the enacted language as well as any other helpful interpretive aids. My comments today will address three main points. First, the highlights of what the prosecution's reading of the limitation statute has going for it that shows that it's the correct reading. Second, some of the numerous problems the petitioner's construction carries, which demonstrate that his take on the statute is incorrect. And third, two particularly glaring contradictions that are inherent in any prospective-only construction of the statute, and that there really isn't any satisfactory answer to. Turning first to the prosecution's reading of the statute, we contend that the General Assembly made its new statute of limitations retroactive. What this contention has going for it, first and foremost, is that it comes from a straightforward and natural reading of the statutory language itself. The statute created for the first time a 10 years from 18th birthday limitations period. And in the very paragraph that created that new period, the General Assembly stated that it shall apply to offenses, and here I quote, which are alleged to have occurred on or after July 1, 1992. So our position of retroactivity is the one and the only one that flows naturally from this statutory edict. Equally straightforward and natural is that the legislature inserted limiting language into the pre-existing old and shorter 10 years from commission period. That provision previously had said that it applied to all offenses committed on or after July 1, 1979. But House Bill 1392 added additional words to that provision, stating that it shall apply to offenses, and again I quote, which are alleged to have occurred on or after July 1, 1979, but before July 1, 1992.
And just to make sure I understand, so that added language came in as part of the 2002 amendment?
Before the 2002 amendment, it said it applies to all offenses committed on or after July 1, 1979. The language that came in with the 2002 amendment was the addition to say, and prior to July 1, 1992.
Okay, so the flat 10-year applied back to crimes committed on or after 1979.
That's right, and I can answer the question you were asking earlier. The statute of limitations for all sex crimes and all felonies, which was originally 3 years, in 1992, two different things were done to extend that for sex crimes against children. One was that a special statute was created, 18-3-411, setting a 10 years from commission statute of limitations. The other thing was that over in the general limitation statute, that 16-5-401, a subsection was inserted saying an additional 7 years shall be added to the period for the following crimes, and it listed essentially the same crimes. So that's when it started. It happened in 1982. None of that legislation expressly said anything about whether it went back or not. And so litigation ensued, arguing over whether it went back or not. There were cases pending before this court in 1985. Both Holland and Midgley were pending before this court, but not yet decided. When the 1985 General Assembly put in language to answer that question. First, it added a section that said, well, when we added subsection 6 to the general statute, which by express terms added 7 years, we did that to make a 10-year statute of limitations for crimes going all the way back to 79, which makes sense. Back to 79 was as far as they could reach, because it was 3 years back from the original 1982 extension. It also added the last sentence in this special specific sex crimes against children statute 18-3-411, and it added the sentence that from that point on read, the 10-year statute of limitations shall apply to offenses committed on or after July 1, 1979. Then in 2002, that sentence was modified to say, but prior to July 1, 1992.
You've done the legislative history research here, and would you agree with Mr. Mueller there that this is a pretty unusual situation, isn't it, where the JBC comes in with some kind of a proviso like this and at the same time then makes clear that it's going to be prospective? That's not the normal course of legislation, is it?
I can't say that something like that hasn't ever happened, but I can say that the JBC doesn't come in and say, because of this retroactive bill, there's going to be some immediate costs. Our statute requires us to pay for them. Let's pay for them and eliminate the need to pay for them by making it prospective.
But it is true this occurred at the same time in that out of ordinary committee process where this was on or after language was actually put in the bill.
It did occur.
This is not a reviser's mistake.
No, it's not a reviser's. The amendment, the actual committee report said, strike the old effective date clause in appropriations and put in a new one. It just said strike the one package and put in another. And it turned out that that other package, the new package, had this curious and now problematic effective date clause. There was no discussion about that. There was at JBC there was no discussion on the Senate floor and on the House.
But this is what is interesting to me, because generally, of course, the District Attorney's Council is tracking these bills like a hawk, right? And nobody caught this that was interested in this retroactive change that they started out drafting?
Nobody caught it. Nobody caught it. And what I have to say is the statutes didn't change. They continued to lay out this clearly retrospective approach. And the focus, I think, had, with regard to the appropriations, the funding, the focus had to be on, we know what the dollars are. We've known ever since the very first fiscal report. We know what the dollars are. We're going to have to find a way to get them. We found a way to get them. Put it in. I think a staff person probably went and found a piece, maybe from another bill or an earlier piece of legislation, and cut and pasted it in.
But it still has to go to the floor of the Senate.
Yes.
Obvious chance to change it back, and that doesn't occur.
That's right. But an obvious chance also for the sponsor to say, we made a change. We decided to go from a retrospective bill, which everybody had been voting on all along, and change it to a prospective bill. Nothing like that was said at all.
So did you check the hearings, the tapes, as they may exist in the hearings?
I did.
In both the Appropriations Committee as well as the Substantive Committee?
I did.
And there, you found nothing that...
There was never any discussion about, should we think about making a prospective only? Never any discussion that that's what we've done. Never any discussion that that would be a way to avoid the fiscal impact. The discussion was, okay, we've got the fiscal impact. Are we going to just say, well, it's small enough we can ignore it? Or are we going to do the responsible thing and pay for it? And the House appropriation said, oh, we can just say it's small enough we can ignore it. The Senate appropriation said, no, let's not do that. Let's find a way to pay for it. But nobody ever talked about one way we could fix this is to avoid any immediate fiscal impacts by making a prospective only.
Council, before you move on, I want to just ask you, I guess I'm assuming that you're sticking with your argument that there is a conflict here. You're not going with the Court of Appeals interpretation that says there really isn't a conflict because we don't have to look at the effective date.
I think the Boston court ended up with the right result, but for reasons that I don't adhere to. I think almost every one of Mr. Miller's points is well taken. I researched the issue before Boston came out, whether there's room to argue that when some language is in a statute and other language is just in other ancillary parts of a bill, the statute prevails. This court has never declared that kind of doctrine. There is one way in which the court could conceivably look and say, well, they're really not in conflict, and that is, the effective date clause doesn't say it's prospective only. It says it shall apply to offenses committed on or after July, or on or after the date of passage, but it doesn't say shall apply only to acts committed on or after that date. I throw that out. I don't ask the court to follow that, because this court has on numerous times looked at provisions that just say it the way this one did. They just say this shall apply to acts committed.
Well, there wouldn't be any doubt if this was a substantive offense. Even in the absence of this language, it would be prospective, right? I mean,
You mean, given that clause?
Well, no, just without the clause. Say if it was effective July 1, and it had to do with the substantive elements of a crime, it would be offenses committed after the effective date of the act, right? Isn't that the normal?
Sure. I suppose FACTA would require that. Well, yeah. Depends on whether it's increasing or decreasing the elements. But
that's well established, right?
Sure.
And even in civil bills, I mean, it's things are prospective unless the legislature indicates otherwise.
Sure. If there's not an indication, the presumption is prospective. So in your hypothesis, there isn't any indication, so the presumption prevails.
Yeah.
In our bill, there's language, express language in the statute that makes it retroactive. And that even petitioner concedes when that was written and inserted in the statutes, it was done so with the intent and the understanding that it had retroactive effect. Another thing that our construction has going for it is that it addresses that the act itself, 1396, did two things that fit and can only fit in a retroactive bill. One is the funding piece, and we've talked about that some. I may talk about it in some more detail shortly. And the other was putting in a provision that the 18 years or the 10 years from 18th birthday applies to second degree sexual assault as it existed prior to July 1st, 2000. Any such crime had to have been committed before this bill came into effect because it had to be committed before the year 2000. And yet the legislature put in specific language saying as it existed before 2000. And that can only make sense if the bill is retroactive in impact.
Where did the year 2000 come from?
In 2000, the sexual assault statutes were modified, and second-degree sexual assault went out of being.
Okay.
There used to be a first, second, and third. It was changed into just one statute of sexual assault. Second-degree sexual assault disappeared.
So it was intended just to cover that change?
It was intended to reach back to that crime, but it had to reach back to 2000 to even get that crime because that crime didn't even exist after 2000. But that couldn't have been just an oversight by the legislature because they had to put in the explicit language, sexual assault under 18.3403 as it existed prior to July 1st, 2000.
Thank you.
I'd like to jump to my second point, and that is some of the problems that the petitioner's prospective construction carries with it. There's not enough time this morning to cover anywhere near all of them, so I'll just highlight two or three. The biggest single problem is that his view strains the statute language beyond reason. Mr. Summers looks at 18.3.411.2b. The 10 years from 18th, and there he finds the 10 years from 18th birthday new limitations period. And he also finds a date specification. And he looks at 411.2a, and there he finds the old, shorter 10 years from commission provision and a separate and different date specification. But he concludes that neither date specification controls the limitations period that it's structurally placed with. Instead, he would have you accept the date specification that's positioned with the new longer period applies instead to the old shorter period that's located somewhere else. And what then are we to do with the date specification that is positioned with that old, previous, and shorter limitations period? Ignore it? Well, not exactly. We're supposed to view it as a partial specification. We're supposed to cobble that date specification with 2B's date specification and accept the cobbled combination as setting out the date range for the old limitations period. But does this even give the complete and accurate date specification? Not exactly, according to petitioner. When we add these two together, what we come up with is all offenses between 79 and 92 plus all offenses from 92 on. But that still isn't right. It has no ending date. And even petitioner says there must be an ending date. Where do we find that? It's not in any statute. It's kind of in the effective date clause, but not exactly. That clause says upon passage. So next we look to the bill's passage date, and discovering that that was June 3rd, we now can accept June 3rd, 2002 as the ending date for the limitations period for the old shorter period, for the ending date for that shorter period. So a partial but incomplete date specification in 2A gets combined with a partial but incomplete date specification in 2B to yield an overly inclusive and incorrect date range that then gets partially peeled back by the passage date to finally arrive at the date range for the old limitations period. That's pretty hard to swallow. It's hard to even say. And what about the date range for the new limitations period? The 10 years after 18th birthday period. Where do we find that date range? Isn't it just the date range that's positioned right there with the period? No, not according to the petitioner. Then is it stated somewhere else in the statute? No, it's not stated anywhere. Instead, it springs from the passage date. We are to ignore the date range that's set out right there with the period and write our own date range from knowing that the bill passed on June 3rd.
Yet all of this said, you're still asking us to strike some material words in a session law that's very specific about what offenses it applies to, right? So how do we get to do that?
I am. This court's task is always to discern legislative intent. When two provisions, the reason we have as many interpretive aids as we have is because, unfortunately, it happens more frequently than we'd like that enacted provisions collide and conflict. This court is frequently called on to resolve irreconcilable conflicts. And when you do that, you have to choose one and discard the other. You can only do that if you're satisfied that you know that was the outcome the legislature intended. If you can't do that, then in this realm, you have to rule for the petitioner because the rule of lenity requires you to. And that ought to be the outcome in the criminal world. But if you can discern the intent, you need to go with that. Even when that means saying, of these two provisions, one we can give a force to and one we must invalidate or discard.
Counsel, since you brought up the rule of lenity, can I follow you on that track?
Please.
I mean, essentially, when do you invoke the rule of lenity? I mean, I guess you're saying your interpretation is better or is more persuasive, and therefore we don't invoke the rule of lenity. I mean, I'm trying to figure out when we would be required to invoke the rule of lenity.
Thank you. The rule of lenity is a rule of last resort. It's when you've looked at everything else and you are still left unsatisfied about what the legislature intended. If you're left to guess, then the rule of lenity provides the final answer. When you know whether you need the rule of lenity in this case is when you've looked at everything else and you can say to yourself, I know what the legislature intended. I'm satisfied that I'm right about that. Or I don't know what it intended, or I think so, but I'm not satisfied.
Mr. Whitley, you now have 10 minutes left.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Whitley, on the rule of lenity, I didn't know that it was just you had to guess. I thought it was when the statute creates an ambiguity, or it's ambiguous. Isn't that the rule when it gets triggered?
No, I think that's. I wouldn't state it that way. If it still is ambiguous after you have considered all the interpretive aids that are available, and it's ambiguous because the intent doesn't present itself to you. When that ambiguity continues after all your work to try and discern intent, then the rule of lenity says, gives you your answer because you're still stuck with the ambiguity. But oftentimes, if it was just whether something was ambiguous, that would mean this court would never be in the business of saying, well, we've got an ambiguity here, we're going to look into it. Remember, this court says if a statute is plain on its face and not ambiguous, then we never turn to interpretive aids. We turn to interpretive aids because there's an ambiguity.
Well, I think part of what you're saying is absolutely right, but we're talking about a criminal statute and the prosecution in a criminal case, so there's a few other things that kick in. I always thought, at least with respect to the application of the rule of lenity. But let's say for a second, I'd like to hear how you apply it. Let's say it's pretty clear from the text of this House bill that they meant to apply it retroactively. Your arguments are very convincing. On the other hand, it's also pretty clear that subsection 5 says it's supposed to be prospective only. So I want you to discuss why we should not apply the rule of lenity in that context. And what's your theory?
Because of all the different pieces you can look at, all the different things you can go to see what did the legislature intend, and because I contend that when you look at all those, you come away satisfied that the legislature intended a retroactive impact.
Mr. Whitley, the problem I'm having with that, and maybe this will help you to answer Justice Bender's question, is it seems to me that your argument that from a lot of the text that you cited reveals the legislative intent, that if I accept that, I'm in the situation where I ignore the effective date clause, and more importantly, I ignore the fact that it reveals a legislative intent as well. In other words, what I'm suggesting to you is you actually have two rather, by your theory, one rather clearly expressed legislative intent from the text, but by any theory, another legislative intent expressed much more succinctly and without interpretive aid expressed in that effective clause, date clause. And so are you saying that somehow we're weighing these conflicting intents and saying that it goes one way rather than the other because of the volume of text involved or the detail? Or how exactly do you determine which expressed legislative intent prevails?
Yes, it is just those things you started to put your finger on that I think help you decide which direction you go and ultimately lead you in only one direction. The details. The fact that the legislation, the statute, when it was written, was structured and written in a way that everybody understood was a retroactive piece of legislation, and that was never changed. That the funding had to come because it was retroactive. That the statute that they cited in the bill itself when they put in the funding was the statute that says pay for the bills impact in the first 5 fiscal years. And only retroactive construction of this statute carries fiscal impacts in the first 5 years.
Mr. Whitley, that gets me to the point that I've been concerned about, which is in Section 5, not only do you have a prospective, very specific prospective language, but then you have this contingency that seems to me to in and of itself reflect the legislature's intent that this is only going to take effect if the funding, the appropriations clause, goes into effect. And so you have kind of a double thing going on there.
Before you answer, you now have 5 minutes left.
Thank you. I'm not seeing anything in the contingent piece of it that gives any suggestion of either prospectiveness or retrospectiveness.
Well, the language, the word I'm looking at is if.
Well,
and this act shall take place if, excuse me, this act shall only take effect if.
Okay.
And that suggests something is going to happen in the future.
Yes. And what's going to happen in the future is that this other bill pending in the same 2002 General Assembly gets adopted and frees up enough money to fund what our bill does. Consider...
Okay, what if that hadn't happened?
Well...
Then we wouldn't have this argument. Then we would have the 10-year statute,
no,
right?
Yeah, we wouldn't, because 1396 would never have taken effect
right,
at all.
Right, right. But it did happen. It did happen in the future after the passage. Oh. Therefore, the language seems to suggest that the passage took place upon this contingent. Now, you say, well, big deal, it doesn't matter, because once that happened, it's still retrospective.
I agree that it took place only because that contingency played out. But I think I can best answer your concern by supposing for a minute that the effective date clause, the applicability part of it, hadn't changed. Suppose it said, this bill shall take effect upon passage and shall apply to offenses committed on or after July 1st, 1992.
Right.
But it also said, but this bill shall only take effect if, and then it laid out all the same contingencies. I submit that all of that contingency part of it would not have any impact on whether it should be prospective or retrospective. It just has impact on whether it's going to happen at all. And
well, I understand that argument, and that makes some sense to me. What I'm doing is reading those two things together, however. And if you look at that, they put it all in Section 5, and they say the Act is going to take effect when we pass it, but only if this happens. That seems to suggest a prospective, a forward-looking absence of an error in that particular clause, Section 5.
I'd like to try and answer that concern. Can you tell me what about that shows that it's forward-looking in terms of what crimes it's going to apply to?
Nothing more than I've already done.
Okay. And I guess I just, I don't see, I'm not able to see what in that bears at all on whether it applies to already committed crimes or not. The legislature had to pay for it. If it couldn't pay for it, it didn't want the bill to go into effect at all, and so it created that contingency. What seems salient to me is that the only reason that the legislature would have to pay for it and therefore would make it contingent is because it has retroactive application, so there's going to be immediate impact on prison population. There would be no need for the contingency if this bill was prospective.
You get about a minute and a half here. I'm going to ask you this one, too. There's also a rubric of construction that the latest in time controls in the event of a conflict. I mean, if we had two different provisions in the law, we would provide them, perhaps go with the later in time. Now, in the way the legislative process works, this bill moves from House to Senate. They make this decision for whatever reason, we don't know. I mean, you have speculation that it was some draft cutting and pasting, yet, you know, the legislature is the one that adopts it. So we have to assume that they did it consciously and knowingly. Now, the House could have rejected this when it came back, right? If they were so sure that they really wanted this as a matter of law retroactive, they certainly could have forced it to a conference committee, refused to accede. You would agree with all of that. So why shouldn't we also put into this analysis that the later in time clause, the prospective piece, was a conscious decision for whatever reason? We may never know, you know, there was maybe a discussion, you know, behind the scenes of some sort, a compromise, so on, that's not on the record. Would you respond to that?
My answer to that is that might have some appeal if the result wasn't an absurd result. But the reason that leads to us to an absurd result is because it gives us statutes that say one thing and don't mean them. And it gives statutes that try to do things that they can't do.
Well, there's no absurdity with making something prospective. I mean, that's generally a pretty good rubric.
No, I'm not saying the notion of making it prospective is absurd. I'm saying if it's a prospective bill, then a bunch of the other things the bill does all of a sudden become absurd because of the prospective.
But isn't that sort of, kind of goes back to what Justice Rice was asking, and that is the way they've built this is conditional with that clause about appropriations. If the appropriations hadn't come through, we would have the absurdity of this act being passed with all these provisions that never take effect.
No, we wouldn't. No, we wouldn't, because the bill, the Section 5 says this bill won't go into effect unless that contingency is satisfied. So if the contingency is satisfied, the money's there, things are paid for.
Your time has expired.
Thank you very much. I do ask this court to discharge its rule and send the case back to the district court for trial. Thank you.
Justice Martinez, I think that's a very important point. This bill was passed on June 3rd of 2002. The bill that is referred to in Section 5, Justice Rice, was passed, I believe, after, in July. I believe it was passed after. I haven't looked that up, but there's something in my mind.
So you're talking, the bill you're saying is the fiscal bill?
House Bill 02, whatever, 1292.
1292. So you're saying that in effect this didn't come into effect until...
The subsequent
bill. Both it was passed and the subsequent bill.
I think it was approved later. Now, I hope I'm right in my recollection. Because I think it's an important point.
I'd be surprised with that. I thought they got out of session in May.
Well, answer.
Well, maybe I'm thinking of the signing date. I mean, that's right. The session usually ends in May.
Well, counsel, answer the response to my question that was given by Mr. Whitley, which is simply that this contingency doesn't make a difference one way or the other.
I think given by itself, I don't necessarily disagree with Mr. Whitley, but I think when you look at the whole history of the bill and the way it happened, it is important because it plays in to what amendments occurred. And then I go back to you, Justice Hobbs, which is what happened last. The Senate, as I understand the history of this bill, never voted on a retroactive bill. They voted on the prospective bill after it came out of the Senate committee. And then, as you pointed out, Justice Hobb, it goes back to the House, and it didn't get amended back to prospective. It got passed. It is the last thing that happened.
According to you, when is the 18 years plus 10 in effect? So June 3rd,
2002.
Or the subsequent bill, the HB 12, whatever it is, 1292?
I think...
Now, isn't that an absurd result as well? I mean, everything here doesn't quite make sense, does it?
I don't think that's an absurd result.
Tell me why not.
Because the legislature said...
But in light of the language in 1834.11.2b, why isn't that just a blatant contradiction?
Well, I think you have to follow the last thing that the legislature said very clearly. If it is a contradiction, then we are to the rule of lenity. And I can't imagine a case more appropriate than for the rule of lenity, as you've now heard both of us.
So your bottom line is we just can't make sense of this, and therefore the rule of lenity applies.
Mr. Whitley likes his argument better. I like my argument better. But at the bottom, you get down to the rule of lenity. And as Justice Scalia said, when interpreting the criminal statute, we do not play the role of a mind reader. He cites Chief Justice Marshall when he rejected the impulse to speculate regarding a dubious legislative intent. Probability is not a guide which a court, in construing a penal statute, probability, you can't safely follow that route, and the tie goes with the petitioner in this case.
Thank you.
Thank you.
On behalf of the court, I thank both counsel for your arguments. The case will stand submitted. And